Imagine you have tickets to a long-running, incredibly famous play. You know the story, you know the lead actor, you know exactly what to expect.
Right.
But the curtain goes up, and the stage is just, it's completely empty. The stars pack their bags and vanished.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but the show doesn't stop. A new actor steps out from the wings. It's an understudy you barely recognize, taking over the lead role. And here's the catch. They don't perform the play the same way at all. The pacing is different, the interactions change, and suddenly, the entire script of the ecosystem is rewritten. Welcome to our listener, the learner, to this custom-tailored deep dive.
That theatrical shift is a really perfect framework for the real-time ecological drama unfolding right now, off the coast of South Africa. We're looking at an ocean in extreme flux where historic apex predators are vanishing and an entirely new dynamic is just sort of taking their place.
Exactly. Our mission today is to explore a massive public awareness campaign regarding these shifting dynamics. We're diving into a fascinating stack of sources you provided to help us figure this out. We've got the archives and educational materials of a pioneering ecotourism company called Shark Lady Adventures. We're also pulling from a scientific blog from Shark Spotters, looking over detailed marine infographics, and examining conservation articles detailing the changing locations of South Africa's sharks.
Blending boots-on-the-ground observation with high-level marine biology gives us a uniquely comprehensive view, I think. We're not just looking at cold satellite data, right? We're looking at decades of human interaction with these animals.
Totally. To you listening, the core question we're answering today is this: what happens when the world's most infamous apex predator suddenly packs its bags and leaves its historic hunting grounds? Who takes its place? Okay, let's unpack this. Because to truly understand this mystery, we first have to look through the eyes of someone who has spent her entire life in the water with these creatures.
Right, you need a baseline.
Exactly. We need to understand the baseline before we can understand the anomaly.
And that brings us to Kim McLean, who is known globally as the Shark Lady. She's an absolute pioneer in South African marine ecotourism. She founded Shark Lady Adventures and has been operating since 1992.
Wow, over 3 decades.
Yeah, over 3 decades in the industry.
And doing it with a 100% safety record, which is just mind-blowing considering her daily coworkers are literal apex predators. I always marvel at the bravery required to be a pioneer in this field back in the early 90s.
Oh, absolutely.
Imagine being the first person to look at a 2-ton great white and say, "I think I'll hop in a metal cage and get a closer look." It's like volunteering to test a space capsule before anyone actually knows that the engineering holds up under pressure.
That's a great way to put it. It was completely uncharted territory back then. But her credentials go much deeper than just, running a successful ecotourism business.
Right.
Long before taking tourists out, she was breaking massive cultural and scientific barriers. She was actually the very first woman allowed to join the Department of Sea Fisheries research teams at sea.
Really?
Yeah. At the time, marine biology fieldwork, especially in South Africa, was heavily male-dominated, and women simply weren't allowed on those vessels.
She obviously proved the outdated rules wrong, though, considering the sources mentioned she was sent on research missions to the Antarctic, and she even earned a spot on the maiden voyage of the research vessel, the Africana.
Right. Her fieldwork was relentless. She later worked with Dr. Leonard Campagno at the South African Museum and became one of the very first people to tag great white sharks in South Africa.
And tagging wasn't easy back then, right?
No, not at all. The tagging process back then wasn't the sophisticated satellite telemetry we have today. It involved incredibly close quarters, rudimentary dart tags, and just a profound understanding of shark behavior to get close enough without causing stress to the animal or danger to the crew, for that matter.
Yeah, and that hands-on experience is exactly why her data is so vital today. Without Kim spending 30 years meticulously documenting great white populations and behaviors, acting as the chairperson of the Great White Shark Protection Foundation, we wouldn't have a reliable baseline.
Exactly.
We wouldn't know that the current disappearance is a massive ecological anomaly rather than just a quiet season.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, her true contribution isn't just thrill-seeking, it's education. By acting as an ambassador, her educational tours changed the narrative from mindless Hollywood killers to essential vulnerable pieces of the marine ecosystem.
She essentially acted as a translator between two worlds. But, for decades, the undisputed star of Kim's educational tours, the main draw for anyone getting into those cages, was the great white.
Right.
But recently, a new co-star has been making waves, Let's look at the tail of the tape between these two predators, because they could not be more different biologically or behaviorally. Starting with the reigning champion, the great white.
Heavyweight.
Yeah. According to the infographics and the Shark Lady educational material, the great white is a heavy-set giant, averaging 4 to 6 meters long, sometimes exceeding 6.5 meters, and weighing anywhere from 1,100 to over 2,500 kilograms.
Massive.
Visually, they have that sharp, unmistakable contrast between a grayish upper body and a bright white belly.
And their biology is entirely optimized for devastating solitary ambush attacks. Great whites possess a rare trait among fish called regional endothermy.
Which means they're warm-blooded.
Basically, yeah. They have a specialized network of blood vessels that allows them to conserve the heat generated by their swimming muscles. This means they can keep their core body temperature significantly warmer than the surrounding water.
Which acts like a biological turbocharger.
Exactly.
It keeps their muscles and brain primed for that explosive predatory behavior they're famous for, where they launch their massive bulk completely out of the water to strike seals.
Yeah, it's incredible. But in the other corner, we have the new arrival moving into the spotlight. The bronze whaler shark, also known as the copper shark or the narrowpith shark.
Okay.
They're much smaller and slimmer, averaging 2.5 to 3.3 meters and weighing only 200 to 300 kilograms.
They're a fraction of the size.
Right. Visually, they have this stunning metallic bronze copper coloring on their upper body that gleams in the sunlight, and their teeth are narrow and smooth compared to the great white's heavy serrated jaws.
Well, they don't eat seals, which explains the smoother teeth. They're mid-level predators, feeding on bait fish, like sardines, as well as squid and smaller sharks. The sources note they are highly social, which is a massive departure from the solitary great white.
Oh, completely. They use cooperative hunting, which relies on complex fluid dynamics and behavioral synchronization. They work together to herd schools of fish into tightly packed spheres known as bait balls. By forcing the fish into this dense clump, the sharks disrupt the lateral line sensory organs of the fish. The fish panic, clump tighter for perceived safety, and become an essentially stationary target. Once the trap is set, the bronze whalers take turns lunging through the mass to feed.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Going back to our initial analogies, the great white is like a solitary heavyweight boxer looking for one massive knockout blow. The bronze whalers are like a highly coordinated pack of wolves, or maybe like a synchronized swimming team of hunters working together to take down thousands of tiny targets.
The name bronze whaler is actually a historical misnomer, too. They certainly aren't built to take down whales. The name dates back to historic commercial whaling days. When whaling ships would harpoon a whale, these copper-colored sharks would aggregate in the oily slicks left behind to scavenge.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. Despite the misleading name, they are perfectly adapted for their specific mid-level niche in the food web.
And that brings us to the massive, real-time ecological drama we teased at the beginning. The heavyweight champions are vanishing from the main stage, and the lightweight synchronized team is moving in. The statistics from the conservation articles are just, they're staggering.
They really are.
In Cape Town, back in 2011, shark spotters documented a peak of over 300 great white sightings across 8 beaches since 2019.
Zero.
An absolute disappearance from historical hotspots like False Bay and Gans Bay.
But a population doesn't just evaporate. The data suggests they haven't died off entirely, but rather they're shifting their location. They're moving eastward from the Western Cape to the Eastern Cape.
Okay.
In Algoa Bay in the Eastern Cape, shore angler catches of great whites went from just 6 in 2013 to 59 in 2019. They're packing up and moving, and the primary suspect is a highly intelligent specialized predator.
Orcas. The killer whales.
Yep.
But I'm trying to wrap my head around the mechanics of this. How does a dolphin relative, even a large one, systematically take down a 2-ton great white and trigger an exodus of hundreds of sharks?
It comes down to incredible tactical intelligence and biological targeting. These aren't just any orcas. They're specialist killer whales that have developed a very specific lethal taste for shark livers. Documented since 2015, these orcas use a hunting technique that exploits a biological glitch in the sharks called tonic immobility.
Wait, is that where they flip them upside down?
Precisely. The orcas ram the shark or bite its pectoral fins to flip it over. When a shark is upside down, it enters a natural state of paralysis, a trance-like state.
That's terrifying.
Once the great white is incapacitated, the orcas perform near-surgical extractions of the liver. They target the liver specifically because sharks don't have swim bladders for buoyancy. Instead, they have massive livers filled with an oil called squalene.
So the liver is basically a giant buoyant sack of pure, energy-dense fat. It's a multivitamin for a killer whale.
It's the most calorically rewarding part of the shark, and they leave the rest of the carcass. The sources mention a specific incident in Mossel Bay where an orca pod killed at least 3 great whites using this method. The response from the surviving sharks wasn't to fight back. It triggered an immediate, massive flight response.
They just left.
The chemical signals of a dead great white in the water tell the others to evacuate immediately.
I have to wonder, though, if a flight response from a localized orca attack fully explains a multi-year absence of hundreds of sharks. I mean, it feels like 300 dropping to zero over almost a decade requires a systemic collapse, not just a reaction to a few specialized hunters.
Okay.
Is it really just the orcas, or is there something else driving them away?
That's a great question. Synthesizing the data reveals a much more complex risk landscape. The orcas are the dramatic catalyst, but environmental factors are quietly shifting the foundation. Remember the great white's endothermy.
Right, the warm-blooded thing.
They prefer water temperatures between 14 and 24 degrees Celsius to maintain their energy efficiency. Broad climatic and ocean shifts over extended periods change where that optimal temperature band is located, gradually pushing the sharks eastward to find comfortable waters.
So the water itself is changing. But there's an even more staggering hidden factor in these sources, commercial fishing. The data shows that great whites overlap with longline and gillnet fisheries in 25% of South Africa's exclusive economic zone.
Yeah, they spend 15% of their time exposed to these risks. The mechanics of these fisheries are devastating for wide-ranging predators. A gillnet is essentially a massive, invisible wall of monofilament webbing suspended in the water. It's designed to snag the gills of target fish, but it doesn't discriminate.
Bycatch. The nets are meant for smaller commercial species, but a great white swims into it, gets tangled, and because they need constant forward motion to force oxygenated water over their gills, they just suffocate.
It's awful. In KwaZulu-Natal, they report the highest catches of white sharks, averaging around 32 per year entangled in these setups. So the great whites are navigating an impossible gauntlet.
Yeah.
They're dodging highly intelligent orcas, extracting their livers, avoiding invisible walls of industrial fishing nets, and following shifting water temperatures eastward just to survive.
They're being systematically squeezed out of their historic home. But nature abhors a vacuum. Trophic cascades dictate that when an apex predator leaves an ecosystem, the mid-level predators below them experience a population boom or behavioral shift. With the great whites gone from places like False Bay, the bronze whalers are stepping right onto the main stage.
The spotlight has officially shifted. Shark Lady Adventures and the Shark Spotters programs are now focusing heavily on the bronze whalers. They've become the unsung stars of the cage diving tours in Gansby. The shark sirens at popular beaches like Musenberg and Fishhook are now often sounding for bronze whalers coming closer to shore to feed in the summer, which is a completely new paradigm for beach safety and ecotourism.
It changes the conservation conversation completely. Great whites are listed as vulnerable by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Bronze whalers are listed as near threatened, but the bronze whalers face a very different, highly commercialized human threat. Unlike many sharks that are tragically hunted just for their fins, bronze whalers are actively hunted for their meat.
This raises an important question about seafood transparency and how our daily habits directly impact these shifting ecosystems. Bronze whaler meat is highly popular in countries like Australia, where it's a staple in fish and chips. But it's almost never sold under the name bronze whaler.
I want to talk directly to you, the listener, for a second. Think about that dynamic. The fish and chips you might order on a vacation by the beach could literally be the apex predator we're talking about today. You could be eating a bronze whaler and have absolutely no idea because it's misleadingly sold to consumers under generic friendly-sounding names like flake or lemon fish.
Right.
It just shows how utterly invisible the seafood supply chain can be to the average consumer.
It's a profound disconnect. Because of this intense commercial pressure and their new prominence in False Bay, science is scrambling to catch up. We need to know exactly how these sharks are filling the ecological gap left by the great whites. The Shark Spotters blog details how researchers like Toby Rogers and his PhD project at the University of Cape Town are stepping in to monitor them.
I'm trying to picture how you even track a shark that migrates 1,000 kilometers.
Yeah.
You can't exactly put a radio collar on it like a terrestrial predator, and they don't surface to breathe like whales do. How are they gathering reliable movement data?
They utilize a multi-pronged technological approach, primarily acoustic and satellite tags. An acoustic tag emits a high-frequency ping that gets picked up by underwater listening stations anchored to the seafloor around the coast. Whenever a tagged shark swims within a few hundred meters of a receiver, its specific ID and the timestamp are recorded.
So that creates like a connect-the-dots map of their coastal movements.
Mm, exactly. And satellite tags take it a step further. They're attached to the dorsal fin and beam an exact GPS location to a satellite every time the fin breaks the surface of the water. Pairing this movement data with environmental data like temperature and ocean currents helps researchers understand why the sharks are moving to specific areas.
Tracking tells us where they are, but the ecosystem script has changed. How do scientists figure out what role they're playing in the food chain now that the big boss is gone?
That's where stable isotope analysis comes in. It's essentially the scientific embodiment of the phrase, "You are what you eat." By taking tiny tissue samples from the shark, scientists can look at the specific chemical signatures left behind by their diet. Carbon and nitrogen isotopes accumulate in different layers of the shark's tissue at different rates.
It's like forensic accounting for a shark's stomach. A blood sample might tell you what they ate last week, but a muscle sample tells you what they've been relying on for the past year.
Exactly. That chemical log reveals exactly where the bronze whalers rank on the full-spay food chain today compared to 5 years ago. It paints a precise picture of their ecological niche. Working with organizations like the Oceanographic Research Institute and the Save Our Seas Foundation, researchers are rushing to understand this vulnerable species before human consumption and ecological shifts push them to the brink as well.
So what does this all mean? If we zoom out and look at this through the 30-year lens of Kim McLean, the Shark Lady, we see an ocean in extreme flux. We've watched the solitary, massive great white, an endothermic giant perfectly evolved for ambush, be pushed out of its historic home. They're being squeezed by specialized killer whales, inducing tonic immobility, shifting ocean temperatures, and invisible walls of human fishing nets.
Yeah.
And in their wake, they're leaving room for the smaller, cooperative, metallic-gleaming bronze whalers to take over the coastal waters of South Africa.
For you listening, it's crucial to understand that these aren't just fascinating biology facts for a trivia night. These shifts dictate the reality of the world around us. They alter the safety protocols of our beaches and dictate whether the warning sirens sound. They determine the survival of coastal ecotourism economies that rely on these animals to draw visitors. They signal cascading changes in the health of the global marine food web. And as we saw with the flake fish and chips example, they even dictate the transparency or complete lack thereof of the seafood on our dinner plates.
Everything is interconnected. The actors on the stage matter. And when the cast changes, the entire production shifts. Which leaves us with one final, unexplored thought to ponder. We now know that great whites possess a dramatic, chemically induced flight response. When the orcas show up and start extracting livers, the sharks pack up and move hundreds of miles east to places like Algoa Bay to escape.
But orcas are highly intelligent, highly adaptable problem solvers. They learn, they communicate, and they optimize their hunting strategies.
Right. So what happens to the marine ecosystem of the Eastern Cape when the orcas realize their favorite meal has moved? What happens when those specialized pods decide to follow the great whites to their new home? If the predator simply follows the prey, the cycle restarts in a new location. Where do the sharks go next? Do they keep running until there's nowhere left to go? The curtain's definitely gone up on the second act of this play, and the stage is set. But honestly, I don't think anyone knows how the script ends.